He's driving home about the time I get to Los Angeles and get my cell phone. I said, Bob, he says, where in the hell are you? And I said, well, I accidentally got on the wrong airplane. I'm in Los Angeles. So that was the big laugh for about 5 years, that John Lear gets on the wrong airplane.
Okay, with your ideas, and they're pretty cutting edge, basically, do your friends agree with you?
I don't have any friends.
Come on, John. I don't believe you.
Friends.
You're one of the most charming guys we've come across.
My good friend Bob Lazar thinks I'm nuts. So.
Does he really?
Yeah. He told us at the birthday party.
And he works on UFOs. So
as a matter of fact, if you'll reach behind you, I would like to read his birthday present to me. It's that cup that says JL.
Right.
Just hand it over here. Okay, now Bob Lazar had this made for me, and this is my birthday present. Basically, what this is
what does it say?
Periodic table of elements, and the periodic table of 116 is JL, and it says it's a human solid, and the atomic mass is 256.89, and it has all the stuff there, and then it says element John Lear, occurrence found primarily in Nevada, physical properties. JL is a rare and unstable element. It is best known for its remarkable ability to resist common sense and facts.
Oh,
applied liberally, JL has been known to improve the quality of lawns. It is also known to absorb great quantities of expensive substances. It is one of the most powerful money-reducing agents known to man. Prolonged exposure to this element can cause severe physical, mental, and financial damage.
Great. Okay, and you've told us off camera that Bob Lazar has gone back in working for the government.
Yeah, he works back at Los Alamos National Laboratories.
What's he working on?
I have no idea. One of the things he told us is when he went back to work, they had a short chat with him, and before they gave him his clearance, they said, now, Bob, you're not going to cause us any more problems, are you? And he said, no.
Well, they basically threatened him to get him to come back in. Isn't that right? I mean, he was having all kinds of problems right before that.
I didn't hear that part.
Okay. But he's been inside for about 4 years.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. And you're saying that it's possible he might give interviews.
Yeah. He did the Travel Channel a couple of years ago, and just the other day did somebody else, you know. But it would be best that you did not mention my name. Just but call him up out of the blue.
Okay,
you know.
But he's your friend, right?
Yeah, he's a good friend. He came to my birthday party, and it was really great. Well, as I've told you, I used to have two wicker chairs here. In 1987, I started talking about UFOs. I gave a lecture at the Spring Valley Library. Well, it created such a ruckus here in Las Vegas. People were calling. There were people wanting to interview me. I mean, it just exploded. And, of course, it disrupted my family here because people were calling. Marilee eventually had my phone shut off. She took all my UFO files. I mean, it was bad. And so in 1988, a guy called. He said, my name is Gene Huff. I'm a real estate appraiser, and I'd like to get some of your tapes and stuff. I said, Gene, I'm out of it. You know, it's almost cost me my family. I'm just not doing it. He says, okay, well, you know, if you ever want to trade some tapes, I'll trade you a real estate appraisal for it. And I said, oh, wait a minute, because, you know, I needed some money. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll get you those tapes and you appraise my house. So he came over the day after that to do the measurements. Of course, he had no idea it was 7,700 square feet. He's complained ever since because he had to do such a huge house for just a couple of tapes and some information. Well, anyway, when he came over, he brought this guy named Bob Lazar, and he introduced him to me. Bob was the guy that holding the end of the measuring tape. And he said, Bob used to work at Los Alamos National Laboratories, and he lives in town now and develops photos. So I said, great, you know. So Gene and I are talking about UFOs, and Bob is rolling his eyes. He said, you guys are nuts. This could not be true. I worked at Los Alamos. I had a Q clearance. If it had been true, I would have known about it. I did enough snooping around there. So he didn't want to hear about any of this stuff. So anyway, that was like in June of 88. So over the next 4 or 5 months, Gene and I and Bob exchanged information. And Bob, you know, there was three or four things that pushed him over of this is totally ridiculous, that it might be true. And one of them was, in those days we knew about a secret facility at Los Alamos called YY-2, and my information was that it was where they held the aliens there. And then there was something else. But anyway, Bob found out, yeah, there was YY-2, and yeah, it was way more classified than he could end. And there was like three or four things. And anyway, in November, that was when Bob decided that, well, you know, I think I'll see if I can get a job up at Area 51. So he called Dr. Teller, who he knew from Los Alamos, and I think I was there when Bob talked to him. And Teller said, do you want to work out here at Lawrence Livermore with me or there in Nevada? And Bob said, I want to work at Groom Lake. And so Teller said, okay, well, let me get back with you. So then Bob had three interviews down at EG&G, and he would come up here after each interview. And I remember after the second interview, the first question was, do you know John Lear? And what do you think of John Lear? And Bob said, yeah, I know him, and I think he sticks his nose into places where it doesn't belong. And Bob told me what I didn't tell him was, I also like to stick my nose into places where it doesn't belong. So he got his third interview, and he told us, you know, he aced him, because they talked about really technical stuff. And he just laid it out, and he said, I did a good job. Anyway, the next thing I know is December 6th of 1988, Bob comes, sits down, and he says, I saw a disc today. And I'm writing out checks there, you know, and I'm not paying attention. I said, what? He says, I saw a disc today. And a disc? Theirs or ours? And he said, theirs. I said, you went to Groom Lake? And he said, yeah. And I said, what are you doing here? I said, obviously they're going to follow you. Why don't you just, you know, work there for a while and then come and tell us what happened? He says, because I have seen you take so much crap over the past 6 months about this. I'm telling you, it's real. I saw it. I touched it, you know. And then we spent about 2 hours talking about stuff. And it was just totally shocking. And
okay, and then, but tell us that story. I mean, we got it on the other tape, but it's just so much fun. Where he sits down and says, John, you'll never know what it's
like.
That was
January. And he'd been up there two or three times, or four or five now, I don't know how many. And I remember January, it was bitter cold, and I had a short sleeve shirt on like this. And Bob comes in and sits there, and you know, he's just on. He's lit. And he wants to talk about something, and we already knew we shouldn't talk in here. So we went out by the pool, and Marilee's coming this way, and you know, she said, what are you two doing? You know, we're going out, you know, to talk, you know, and she's suspicious of anything anyway, so she doesn't believe that for a second, but she lets us go. So we went out in that little back place by the stable, and I'm looking at him, said, what? He said, John, you will never know what it's like to see your first alien. I said, you saw one? He said, yeah. I said, it couldn't have been a doll, it couldn't have been, no, it was one. And, you know, these days you ask him that question, he says, well, I don't know. Could have been a doll. They were doing all these weird stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But that night, that's exactly what he said.
Okay.
And I said, how did it happen? He says, well, I was walking down the corridor. He said, I got a guard on each side. And he said, I walked by this door, and there's like a 12-inch window pane, has wires through it. And I looked through it, and there's two guys in lab coats facing me and an alien standing up talking to them. Now, did I show you that picture?
No, I don't think so.
Because he drew it for me.
Oh, really?
Do you want me to, get out?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
These are a lot of stuff I kept from Bob. For instance, here's how security clearance works. The lowest clearance you can get is top secret. And then above that, there's 28 levels of top secret crypto. And then above that, there's 10 levels. Now, these aren't the real names, except the top one is Majestic. Now, each one of these are compartmentalized so that you may have top secret crypto 25, but you don't get to know all that information. All you get to know is what you're cleared for. In other words, when you get top secret crypto 25, somebody doesn't come and tell you this is all the stuff that the guys at top secret 25 get to know. It's compartmentalized. So we had this to show that the President of the United States is like top secret crypto 17. He doesn't need to know very much. He's a figurehead. He's told what to do. So he doesn't really need to know all this. The last president, my understanding, the last president that was given any kind of a briefing was President Nixon. Ford knew a little bit. Reagan knew a little bit. Of course, Bush knew something because he was, you know, director of the CIA. That doesn't mean they tell the director of the CIA anything. He's in appointed office. And they hate appointees, so he knew that from other reasons. But anyway, this is how that chart worked. And these are the when Bob decided not to go back to work for the government. We took him into three regressive hypnosis sessions, and they were Lane Keck. And Lane was supposed to be at my birthday party, and I don't remember why he didn't come, or maybe he did come. I think he did come. We'll see on that DVD. But he did the regressions for Bob. And what we tried, it was extremely interesting. The first one we didn't get because the tape recorder broke. And Gene Huff has those on notes. But the second one, I had the second one. And that's where we tried to pull the information out of. And I'll tell you what here later if you want. I have a transcript of the second one. And I'll let you read it. Because it's extremely interesting.
That's great.
This is when Bob was telling me how you went forward and backward in time. And
I was going to ask you that. So Bob worked on time travel, didn't he?
He didn't work on it. He was briefed on it. See, when he went up there.
He knew Teller. He must have. And he worked at Los Alamos. I mean,
he only knew Teller because he met him that day in front of Los Alamos when Teller was giving the speech, and Bob was on the cover of the Los Alamos Times with his jet car, and he walked up to Dr. Teller and said, "That's who I'm the guy you're reading about." And Dr. Teller said, "Oh, really neat." And then they had a little chat. That's the only place he knew him from. He didn't work with him, but he did work at Los Alamos, and he did listen to Teller talk. Uh-huh. So Bob, when he went up to S4, they asked, you have to choose what you want to do. You can't have a little bit of it all. You have to choose, you know, do you want to be, you know, work on this or that? And Bob wanted to work on reverse engineering the propulsion. That was his job. But he got briefed on all this. And what he's showing me here is how you go forward in time, which is just exerting a strong gravitational pull. And how you go aft. And he started drawing it like that, and then he put his screwies on. I don't know. Was, you know. So anyway, these were the Bob Lazar 1987. He was drawing me the different shapes of vehicles that were at S4. And this one, what he's doing here is he's showing me one had been hit by a projectile. And when I first... let's see here. When I first started showing Bob the pictures of the moon and showing him stuff that was on there, you know, I was saying, look at this, you know, vapor and this and that. And he kind of looked at me real skeptical. And then he said, you know, John, I walked out the door. And then walking out of the door of his home, he says, you know, John, if any of this stuff is true, I'm going to have to kill myself. And so I said, you know, why don't I get that on paper, Bob? So I had him sign this thing that says, I, Bob Lazar, promise to kill myself if any of John's moon stuff is true. Signed, Bob Lazar, August 23rd, 1996. Well, what happened is, when I finally got somebody, you know, when I ordered that photograph from NASA, you know, they sent me the negative. It was a, you know, it was a 16 by 20 negative.
Right.
And it took me, you know, 5 or 6 years before the technology got even to Las Vegas to make a positive that size negative. So when I got it, I took it over to Bob's house, and there's a little one right here. This was the first I got, and I took it over to Bob, and he scanned it. And those are the scans went on ATS. And so up here, I'll let you do a close-up later, there's obviously what looks like a parking garage. So Bob looks at it, he says, yeah. He says, I got to admit, that is not natural. That is something. And so I said, you know, Bob, we've been friends for a long time, and you know, I know you're a man of your honor. And you have agreed that if any of my moon stuff was true, that you would kill yourself. And he says, well, is there any way I can get out of it? And I said, yeah. As a matter of fact, why don't you just sign this statement here? And this is August 5th, 1998. This is 2 years later. It says, I, Bob Lazar, in return for not having to honor my commitment to kill myself, if any of John's moon stuff was true, do freely admit that the object in the crater Copernicus on the moon, saved as apple crate, is a box which I don't know what is doing there. Signed, Bob Lazar. Now, that's the best I could get him to do,
okay.
But that is really the infamous parking garage on ATS that I show everybody, and people say, no, I don't see a parking garage. But I'll show you the enlargements later. But anyway, these are some more. This is the original drawing he did on how the antimatter reactor worked. And this is how he showed me the arches were
And that was what year?
This is all between December and March of December of 1988, March of 1899. And these are the notes I kept. Meeting with Bob Lazar, November 2nd, 1988, because I typed up this stuff.
I see.
And
now,
it says,
did he draw an alien for you or not?
Yeah.
You got it there? We'd love to see that.
I realize that's what we read to get this. Now, the original is blue, and I'm sure it's here somewhere, but this is the original drawing he made me, drawn by Bob Lazar, January 1988, disc hangers at S4, position of gray in relation to two scientists in lab coats, size, orientation, and construction of window through which he saw scientists and the gray. So he was scribbling all over. This is the test site and where S4 was. This was the length of the hangers, 360 feet, and each bay was 40 feet long. This was how the saucers sat in the hangar. And this drawing right here is the two, this is what Bob drew. These are the two lab technicians, and that's the little alien facing the other way. And he drew the door, and he drew that wire going through the window. He said he looked through that and saw those guys right there.
That's great. Did they ever have any exposure, like communication with them?
Yeah, three times, at least three times.
Really?
And I'll just show this because this was on the back side of the piece of paper. This is Aurora, and this was the airplane we have that cruises at 250,000 feet and goes Mach 12, and that was in 1988. And this is what it looked like when he stepped down from the Boeing 737, when he walked down the ramp. This way, that thing was parked towards him, so he was looking up the tail. And he said it was absolutely enormous. He said there was two giant squares where the exhaust was, and he said a man would look like a little doll, you know, standing in those.
Wow. He's looking at it from behind.
He's looking at it from behind.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know exactly. He just assumed that that's what it looked like in plan view.
Wow.
So anyway, the three times that he saw the alien was the first time was when they gave him the pine-smelling fluid. And what they did, it's really interesting, when Bob came in here the very first day, and he said, I saw a disc. I said, and he used to wear a ring, and I forget which finger it was on. I said, okay, now listen to me, Bob. They're going to give you some drugs and to make you forget what you're doing. So what I want you to do is when they take you in to give you the drugs, I want you to take your ring off subtly and put it on your other hand. You won't remember, but when you come up to see me, I'll see it and you'll know you already take the drugs.
Oh,
he said,
wow.
They already did that today. I said, they did. And he said, and he described this elaborate drug test of, you know, how they took a needle and they put a rectangle on his, scratched a rectangle on his arm and then made lines like this and lines like that. And then they'd take stuff and they'd put into each little square like that. And then they took him into a room. And he said the room was just like a regular doctor's office. And there was a couch. And he laid on the couch. And he said there was a screen and blocking something. And he said he knew the alien, the gray, was behind it. Then there was a military guy with an M16. And a doctor and a nurse. And they had him drink the pine-smelling fluid, and he drank the cup, and immediately he felt, you know, dizzy. And he said, he described exactly what he felt like. He said he felt like he was in a well that was 100 feet deep, that his arms were 100 feet long, and he was just holding on to the sides of the well, just barely with his fingertips. That's what he felt like.
Huh.
He said then they started to read the clearance with which he was, the briefing of the clearance with he was being given. So they'd say, you know, they'd read a sentence and then say, and I understand that, you know, I am being briefed. And at the end, the soldier would take the M16 and poke it into his stomach like that. And he said it really hurt. And each different phase of the clearance, the soldier would take the M16 and poke it into his solar plexus. So, and so in the tapes that Lane Keck did, when we were trying to get the information out, you know, they told him a lot of really interesting stuff. And when we would get to, you know, well, what's going to happen in the future, you know, he'd say, I'm not supposed to talk about that. And then Lane would try to work around it with some subtlety, and Bob would grab it, says, no, I can't, it hurts.
Oh, nice.
And
wow.
So that was the...
So like a programming thing.
Right.
So did he ever do the ring? The ring trick?
No, because he had already done it. You know, he said they already
drank. But he had to keep going to work, so.
See, the reason he quit was because when we got caught, you know, he invited us up to see the flying saucer flights March 21st, 1989. And I have that tape right here, and I'll show you. It's only a couple, 9 minutes long. We took that Celestron 8, and we saw... you know, he told us when it was going to fly, and me and Gene are right there, and I focused in on it, and I saw a flying saucer, you know, and it was, you know, tilted about 40 degrees, and it was gold, and it had the stuff radiating off, and I said, quit, Gene, quit, take a look. And as I stepped back, I hooked my foot around the thing, so... that came up at the birthday party because everybody at the birthday party was supposed to tell a John Lear story. And that was Bob's story. And
okay, well, also the story about getting stopped on the road and the guns in the car.
That was when the county sheriff stopped us. And that was the third time we got caught. But the point of that story was that when they took him in the next morning to Indian Springs, which is the center of all the security, and took him out of the car with a gun in his ear, they said, now, Bob, when we gave you this clearance, it meant you were not supposed to tell all your friends about the flying saucers. Now, do you want to work here or not? And that's when Bob was noncommittal, because the last two flights he had taken up to Groom Lake, he could remember walking up the steps and walking down, but he couldn't remember anything in between, and he said he didn't want to work on a program like that.
Well, what about the tall whites? Because from what I understand, you know, Charles Hall talks about the tall whites being out at Indian Wells, that area. You know anything about
no.
that?
Mm-hmm.
Bob ever talk about the tall whites?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No, only the graves. And he only had the three times. The once was when the pine-smelling fluid. And the once was seeing him in the room. And then once, when George Knapp hired Tavernetti to come up and do the lie detector test, George rented a room at Caesar's Palace. And Bob and Gene Huff got there early, and they knew the room. And so they pulled the door open, and Gene pulled the door open. Bob looked inside, and he turned white, nearly fainted. And he walked over, and he sat down in a chair. And Gene says, "What in the heck is the matter with you?" And Bob said, I just had a flashback. He said, I remember talking with the gray. And what had happened is when they opened the door, the way that Tavernetti had said, set up there, it wasn't very much light. It was one single table with a chair on one side and a chair on the other side and some equipment there. It triggered this reaction of Bob when he was reading the briefings and the gray was across from him. And it was such an overwhelming experience of when you first, you know, are in the presence of a gray, when, you know, you're used to asking a question and then having somebody respond. But when you're talking to an alien, they pick it up from your mind and they're answering before you can get out of your mouth, and it gets confusing. And it was just an overwhelming experience. So that was the other time that Bob had the...
Do you think he'll go on camera with this stuff?
I doubt it. But, you know, you never know what he's going to do. Never know what he's going to do. Okay. So let me look through here. This is the page when we were trying to think of the guy he worked with, Castrioloni. But I think we finally determined what the guy's name was. And George Knapp has it, but I don't know what...
So is George Knapp working for the agency?
No, George Knapp works for Channel 8. Oh, you mean undercover?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. George knows a lot of stuff. And he had me on a couple months ago. And what he was doing was a story on Sandia. Sandia is the most secret, or not the most secret, it's the secret base here that replaced Groom Lake Area 51. And it's out on the Paiute Mesa. And I got a map of it here. They started building it in 1980 and finished it in 1987, so it's now 20 years old. About, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people work out there. I mean, it's a huge underground base, absolutely enormous. I mean, there's great big cylinders of offices and stuff that go, you know, a mile deep, and then out on the... test site, there's a couple of runways with all new hangars there and everything. It's just a massive operation. So when George went up there to film it, and he couldn't find it, but anyway, I'll show you. As a matter of fact, I have it here on DVD. I'll show you the exact thing that we did. I told him that one of the interesting things was that how do we get the people out there? They can't drive out there because it's too far. Can't have that many people on Highway 93 or 95 because we'll be exposing that stuff. We can't put them on the 737s because they're already full now, you know, and we can't put on more airplanes going out there. So what they did is they built a high-speed train that goes from Sandia down to Vegas. And what they did is they put the stops under two of the major hotels so that the guys, you know, it just looked like gamblers or, you know, hotel guests walking in there, and they go in there, they open a door, do the card key, and go down, you know, to the thing. And it was great how they do that.
Which hotels, you know?
Yeah, but I'm not going to say.
That's great.
So I got to show you.
Have you ever taken the train?
No.
You know where it is. You can, you know.
I've been meaning to go down there, you know, but I try to stay out of trouble. Here's the Los Alamos monitor that Dr. Teller was reading when Bob was.
Okay, yeah, that's great stuff.
Yeah, I have a friend, Jim Goodall, and he said, "I'm coming down there. We're going to go up to the test site." And I said, "You know, I used to do that stuff, but I'm still alive, so you know, it's all the same to you." I don't want to do it. Here's three things that I wrote down that were important. I came up with the speed of time, and Bob said, you know, I told him what it was. He said, that's correct, but he said, who cares? And what I said was the speed of time is directly proportional to the amplitude of the gravitational flux. In other words, the speed of time is dependent on gravity. And then Bob told me it is theorized that there is one black hole for every galaxy. It's theorized that every black hole has its own galaxy. HIV, the protein code, is on the virus itself. And the recycle time of the gravity amplifiers is 10 milliseconds. Now, the HIV, have we talked about HIV?
No, but we can definitely go there.
AIDS was invented by a Navy surgeon named R.M. Donner. And when Bob read the read the briefing up at S4, one of the things that impressed him is that in the paper, all the briefings he read were, you know, 50, 100 pages with a blue cover, and they were scattered on this table, and he could take each one. And what it was that as he progressed his clearance, these briefings would, let's say this is one briefing, it would be stapled here. And as his clearance progressed, you know, they would unstaple a few more pages. But anyway, on the briefing of AIDS, and I have the... it's probably in here, because I wrote a whole thing on what he told us. It was developed, you know, to get rid of a certain segment of or number of human. But it was developed by R.M. Donner, and it has the exact cure for AIDS. And it has to do with the cucumber Trichosanthus curalawi, which was only grown in China. We tried to get it out of China, three attempts, but... however they know, somebody knows, and each one had been cooked either by a microwave or something as it passed through customs, so it's impossible to get it out. But I'll read you the exact cure and how it works, and
wow.
If you could...
Well, we have a contact right now who says he worked on that, on engineering the AIDS virus in Africa.
Possible, but it wasn't in Africa, it was here, and it was released in Africa, but it was developed up at S4. So Bob and I looked for R.M. Donner. We found him. He lived in Santa Fe. And he was retired. And we went to see him several times because Bob then had the contract for the repairing the alpha probes. And what we used to do is we used to drive to Los Alamos from here. It was a 16-hour drive. And... Bob had a friend there, and it used to take us like 24 hours to rebuild all these alpha probes. There was like 300 of them. And we'd clean them all up and then rewire them and then put the aluminum tape on them, and then we'd drive back to
Las
Vegas.
What's an alpha probe?
They scan for radiation of the people that go in and work in Los Alamos.
Oh.
And Bob had the contract. So we did that about every 6 weeks. So what we do is we try to, we knew where Donner worked, and we go there and we missed him every time, and then we finally got his home address, and we went to his home and we could never catch him home. Now, whether he was not answering the door or whether he was not really there or whether we didn't really have an address, I think we did. We never met up with him. Now, when Bob started to make some money on the photo business and the alpha probes, we went on the airline to go to Albuquerque, and we'd rent a car to go up to Los Alamos. So this one day, and the same things happened on this one day, and I told this in the John Lear stories. I'm going to tell this on myself. So I have trouble recognizing Earth people. For some reason, I just can't, if I don't have known them for 25, and even if I do know them for 25 years, it's hard for me to pick them out of a crowd. So what we would do is to go to Albuquerque, Bob would buy a ticket on Southwest, and I'd jump seat with my airline ID. So one morning we get ready to go, we're going to leave at 7 o'clock, and I go to the airport, and I don't want to get on the airplane unless he's on it. And I walked up and down at all the passengers and looked very carefully. I couldn't find Bob. So I didn't want to get on if he wasn't there and I couldn't reach him at home. So when everybody got on, I asked the flight attendant, I said, hey, I'm a jump seat on, but I want to be sure a friend of mine, could you announce, ask Bob Lazar to ring his call button? Well, of course, what I had forgotten is on this particular flight going to Albuquerque, that's all the Sandia and other guys that go on this flight. So when the flight attendant would Bob Lazar please ring his call button? Of course, the whole airplane, everybody starts laughing because they think it's a joke.
That's great.
So anyway, he rang his call button. I realized he's there, so I got in the jump seat and went to Albuquerque. We got rented a car, drove up to Los Alamos, and for some reason this day, everything went perfect. I mean, we just slid through that thing in about 8 hours. And so we realized that we could drive back, get on the airplane, and have dinner at our favorite Italian restaurant called Parma's. So we pack all this stuff up and write the bill, and we go tearing down the mountain from Los Alamos to Albuquerque and down the freeway. We screech into the rent-a-car place, jump right on the van that's just pulling out, get to the airport. Bob runs up, you know, and gives his ticket. I run up, you know, and sign my, you know, jump seat, you know, run in. They close the door. I run, sit down, and I heard the captain say, welcome to Southwest Airlines 304 on our flight today to Los Angeles. And I realized that I had rung down the wrong gangway and got on the wrong airplane. So meanwhile, Bob is on the airplane waiting for me, and he sees him shut the door. And he can't figure out where I went. So all the way to Las Vegas, you know, he says, well, maybe he got into the cockpit, and I didn't see him. So they get to Las Vegas, and, you know, it takes much longer to get to Los Angeles, so I couldn't call him. And he gets to Las Vegas, and he goes up to the cockpit, and I'm not there. And he cannot understand how we could have been so close, and I didn't get on the airplane. So he's driving normal about the time I get to Los Angeles and get my cell phone. I said, Bob, he says, where in the hell are you? And I said, well, I accidentally got on the wrong airplane. I'm in Los Angeles. So that was the big laugh for about 5 years, that John Lear gets on the wrong airplane. The information that Bob got up at S4 was AIDS is a virus that is protected by the protein coat on the RNA preventing the antibodies, the T4 cells, of the immune system from detecting and eliminating it. The alleged cure for AIDS lies in the excrement of the white fungus that's grown from the Chinese cucumber Trichosanthus curlaui. This excrement, which develops after about 2 or 3 weeks, is separated with hydrazine sulfate in an acidification process which dissolves the protein coat on the RNA and exposes the nucleus of the virus that's detected by the antibodies of the immune system. Regardless of how weak the immune system is, the virus will be destroyed. No more than 20 cc dose per 36-hour period should be administered. No antibiotics should be used during this period. The 20 cc's are metabolized in 36 hours, having dissolved the protein coat on the virus. And I mentioned here, over the last 20 years, I've been party to several attempts to get samples of the Trichosanthus curlaui out of China, but all have met with failure. The last samples having been cooked during departure procedures. Now, the October surprise is in 1980, when Reagan and Bush were running against Carter and Mondale. As you know, the hostages were still in Iran, in Tehran, and then Vice President, or then Bush, took an airplane to Paris to meet not with the Khomeini, but a representative of the Khomeini. And the deal was, if the Khomeini would delay the release of the hostages until Reagan's inauguration, that the Reagan-Bush administration would supply him, the Iranian regime, unlimited guns and ammunition throughout their administration, which would go from 1980 till 1988. My part in that was to deliver those guns and ammunition from Tel Aviv to Tehran. The reason I brought this up is that big sheet of papers over there is the details of who was flying and how they pulled the whole thing off. The way they pulled it off is Bush left Saturday night on a back 111 jet, which only took about 6 or 7 hours to get there. He only spent about 4 or 5 hours in the meeting, and then he was flown back in an SR-71 from a base in France to McGuire Air Force Base, and it only took an hour and 14 minutes. That way he was able to show up for a tennis appointment that he had on Sunday, and that the press would have not known of the lapse in time or the trip. And as it turned out, they were elected, and they supplied these guns and ammunition. And that was, you know, part of the Iran-Contra, but Congress never went back as farther than 1985 to find out when it originally started. And when I moved to Egypt in 1981, that was going to be my job, was to take those arms and ammunition from from Tel Aviv to Tehran. They were coming into Tel Aviv from Zaragoza, our Air Force base in Spain, and Mossad was handling the whole thing. The reason I never did fly a flight, and the reason was the first airplane in was a Argentinian CL-44, and what they wanted to do was use an old turboprop airplane to be sure everything went fine and there were going to be no problems. And for some reason, it got shot down on its way out. And it got shot down over Russia, about 40 miles south of Yerevan, and which is well inside Russia. And the Mossad couldn't figure out how the pilots got off course. They were on their way out. They had dropped a load, or, you know, already dumped the arms and ammunition off. And they've finally figured out that what must have happened is the pilots were intercepted by the Russian MiGs, who knew what was going on and didn't like it. And the pilots thought, well, you know, might as well follow them because we've got nothing on board. They can't prove anything. And then as soon as they got them over Russia, just shot their ass down, which was a message to Mossad, hey, we don't want this to go on. So that big sheath of papers, you know, was the history behind the October surprise. There were two books, one Gary Sick and Barbara Honecker, each wrote books about it. Congress went as far as to actually launch an official investigation in 1990, but it was all covered up because, you know, nobody wanted to go back that far, hear any more stories about that thing. But the hostages did spend October, November, December, an extra 4 months there.
Because so Reagan could be elected.
Right.
Incredible stuff.
And a lot of people know this story, but, you know, it's been, 30 years, and pretty much everybody's fine. The only reason I brought it up is because I'm putting the history there of who the pilots were.
What do you know, anything about the Minot, the recent incident with the Minot Air Force Base and the weapons that were, the nuclear warheads that were attacked?
That smells to high heaven. I followed that on ATS. It was very, very thorough. It was one of my favorite threads. It went on forever, and we had some guys at ATS that really knew what they were talking about, and that was extremely interesting. It had to be Cheney. It couldn't have been anybody else that authorized it, and it was one of the most double-dealing instances I've ever seen.
What would you say it was a setup for, though? Why'd they do it?
You know, that's the question. Why did they? They had nuclear weapons already in Europe. Why did they need to steal them? You know,
and why they need to fly them from, you know, from North Dakota or whatever it was, South Dakota, across the United States? I mean, what was the point?
It's crazy. There is no point. Well, there is a point, but I don't know what it is.
Oh.
But that episode was extremely interesting. I'd sure, you know, one day we'll find out. You know, and we'll say, oh, that's what it was all about. But I don't know. But that was really. It's Minot.
Yeah, Minot, North Dakota.
That's the French pronunciation.
Yeah.
We Americans call it Minot here.
I see. Okay.
I'm kidding you.
Okay, so where are we going next, John? What do you have?
I don't know. While we're figuring about where we're going next, I just ordered this book. Somebody, it just accidentally came up there. It's called The Gravitational Force of the Sun by Perry Spalter. It was written in 1993. And basically what it says here, this book is a serious challenge to Newton's law of universal gravitation that is presently formulated. And I'm just, you know, this far in it. And basically why that interests me is because Newton did have some ideas about the moon, along with, you know, throughout history, about 36 other people who thought there was gravity on the moon, there was atmosphere, and there was people up there. But each one, you know, got gently, the information got gently suppressed.
Well, we have bases up there. Is that, that's
no,
really what no we've been told?
No question about that. We have bases on Mars. You know, the secret astronaut corps has been to visited every planet,
most of the planets,
and much farther than that. We've been to other solar systems. People, when we talk about other planets, say, "Well, it's too hot in Venus." No, that's bullshit. The sun is an electromagnetic sphere. It's not a nuclear reactor, and it doesn't radiate heat as such. It radiates electromagnetism. And each planet has its own filtering system. And so the filtering system around each planet determines what the temperature is. So temperature on Venus is, you know, much like Earth, so it is on Mars, so it is on Pluto, so the same on Mercury. There's people just like us and every single one of the planets that you hear about as being giant
gases.
Like Saturn and Neptune, there's only one gas giant in our solar system, and that's NASA, NASA. That's the only gas giant we have. All the rest of the, you know, planets people live on and happen.
Okay, so what do you think? They're being shrouded? You think there is a, you know?
We're being suppressed. The information is being suppressed. We're not allowed to know about any of that. The people that Hoagland talk about have taken over, and they consider space their personally theirs, and they don't want to share it with any of us. They have technology that we wouldn't have to pay for gas or electricity right this single minute.
Right.
But they don't want to share it with us. It's only for the elite, and we're not included there. We can go to war and, you know, and be subjects for weapons and tests and stuff like that, but we are not going to share in that technology. But out there, there's a fantastic universe, fantastic set of planets. It's really interesting out there.
John, I would like to ask you a few questions.
Basically,
sure. On behalf of the people who are watching this video, we're asking these questions on their behalf. Mm. First of all, I want to say that our source, Henry Deacon, told me personally, I don't think this is on our site, because for me it felt outlandish. He said that there's life on every planet in the solar system. He looked me in the eye and he said, "You may well not believe this, but I promise you it's true."
Yeah.
He said that Venus is not as hot as they want you to believe. He said the sun doesn't work the way that they teach you in school. He said a whole bunch of stuff that corroborates what you're saying. Now, he was on the inside. He's worked in deep black projects all over the place in a number of establishments. And so his source comes from briefing documents, conversations with other physicists, and so on and so forth. Where do you get your information from here? Because this is so extraordinary and way off the end of the spectrum that people need to know how you figured this out, or who's told you this, or what your sources are.
Specifically the sun, that came from a document in the Branson files. Branton files.
Okay. So have you ever met Branton?
No, but we used to talk a lot, and I'm not sure whether I ever met him face to face, but his name is what? His real name?
I don't know.
I forget his real name, but he's...
Anyway, Dave, I think it's Dave... something. But anyway, we used to be real close, and then he got sick for a while, and I don't know what he does, but his information is so interesting, and I have no reason to believe that most of it's not true. Have you read the Brand files?
Oh, yeah,
they're
absolutely
lengthy. I have a 3-inch binder that I had him printed out.
I mean, he's the one who really publicized the Dulce Base information big time in those files. And you're familiar with all of that, right?
The whole Dulce story started in 1987 when me, Linda Howe, Tom Adams, and several others met in Crestone, Colorado, to discuss the state of UFOs. And during that meeting, it was about 3 or 4 days, Tom Adams walked over to me, he said, handed me a note, and it'll turn up eventually, but I don't have it right now. And the note was from him, from who I call Mr. X, in Henderson, Nevada, and told him about that he had a friend that worked at an underground base in New Mexico, that the halls went on forever, tile walls, and a little bit of the stuff. And Tom handed me, he says, John, I don't have time to go out there and research this. Would you look into it? And I said, sure. So when I got back, and before I got back, me and Linda Howe went in my truck all throughout New Mexico. We stopped and talked to Ernie Edwards, who was the key figure in the Benowitz deal. And then she and I drove down through Corona and to see Clifford Stone. And she and I took that road that goes from Corona over to the main highway down to Roswell. And we're going to find the Roswell Ranch. And we get to the turnoff, and there's 30 dead cows there. And it was crazy. And so they didn't have the classic mutilations, but they were dead. And we talked to the farmer there, and he said, oh, yeah, there's some kind of a virus going around. And I forget what the whole story was, but none of it made any sense. And we went down and interviewed Clifford Stone, and then I eventually drove back to Las Vegas and met with Mr. X. And Mr. X started telling me about Dulce, about the guard that had witnessed the atrocities that were going on there and didn't agree with them and had decided to escape. And he escaped with allegedly 7 minutes of videotape that showed the hallway, 25 black and white photos, and 100 pages of information.
Now, we're told this is buried on top of a mountain and is inaccessible.
I'll get to that. So,
and that guy is Thomas Costello, is that correct?
Thomas Costello. So, Mr. X had met Costello, was very good friends with her. And when he escaped, he made 6 of these boxes. And what he did is he gave a box to each one of his friends. And Mr. X was one of them. And Mr. X took me down to Dolan Springs, where he hid his box on the top of a mountain. Now, I didn't go to the top of the mountain or see exactly where it was, but he showed me, where it was generally. So we get back, and I talked to Mr. X over a period of 3 or 4 months, and eventually he shows me some pencil drawings that he drew from the original photographs. Those became the infamous Dulce papers, and I have the originals right here that I drew from those pencil drawings. And so I drew them.
And what are they drawings of?
Of the interior of Dulce.
I see. Well, I don't know if we've seen them or not, but can we get those on camera?
Yeah.
Okay. Do they contain any pictures of aliens?
No, they show the lab and all the hookups of the bags and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And
those
so
are the drawings that were published in Matrix 2, is
right,
that correct?
Yeah, right.
We know the ones, yeah.
Matrix 1, they were sure.
Matrix 1, okay.
And the way that Matrix happened is when I was getting into all this, a guy kept coming to the knocking on the door, John Grace, and, hey, I'd like to talk to you. And that was the time when I was having so much trouble with Marilee, and I kept saying, don't come here. I don't want to talk about it. Finally, he came in, and we developed a long relationship of collaborating on the information. And Matrix 1, every page came off that desk. I wish I had that book. My mom passed away, and there was one left that she had in mint condition, and I gave it to one of my nieces. So I don't have an original Matrix 1. I have an original Matrix 2, and now it's up to Matrix 5. Anyway, John Grace was a really interesting guy. He did a hell of a lot of research. He worked for Nellis Air Force Base, and one day during this period, like late 87, He wrote a kind of a state of the research where we were at as far as what we had found out, and he wrote it. He wanted to get it out, but he didn't want to use his name. So he wanted to suggest a name, and I said, well, why don't you call it Krill, K-R-I-L-L, because the Pentagon dealt with an alien back in 94 called Krill, C-R-L-L-L. And he said, okay. And then he came up with a, out of the blue, the initials O-H. It became the O-H Krill Papers. And we weren't trying to shine anybody on. We were trying to put any false information out. It was just what we thought the state of the art was then, and John wanted to know, and we made up that name. So later it became a full-fledged disaster because Bill Cooper started coming up then, and Bill Cooper and I did several video interviews, and one of them was this PM Magazine in Salt Lake City. And during that interview, they asked about the Krill Papers, and Bill Cooper said he'd seen them in the Navy 20 years prior when, you know, John Grace and I had dreamed them up like 2 months prior to that. And the other thing was there was a paragraph out then talking about the Excalibur weapon, and the Excalibur weapon was a weapon that the military were developing that would penetrate 1,000 feet of soil. And Bob Lazar had written that like 2 months prior. And Bill Cooper had said he'd seen that in the Navy 20 years prior. So I took Bill Cooper out in that dining room. I said, what in the hell are you talking about? John Grace and I wrote that Krill Papers. And Bob Lazar wrote the Excalibur. He said, well, that may be, but I saw him in the Navy. So that's when Bill Cooper and I started to split because I couldn't understand why he was saying stuff like that. And then it became known as UFO disease. And UFO disease is when you get so popular in the UFO field and you don't have anything new to say, you make it up.
Okay, well, let me ask you something, because as far as I know, the Matrix books are written by Val Valerian, who is
John Grace,
right?
Right.
Okay, so Matrix 5 talks about Planet X, I'm told. I've got Matrix 5, and
it's
I remember seeing Planet X referred to in there, but, you know, basically, I was just told that it reminded, I guess, that it talks about Planet X. I mean, it certainly talks about everything in there. But, and you say Planet X is a complete fallacy. So are you still in touch with John Grace? Do you know why he says it's true?
No, I don't know. John Grace, you know, I ordered Matrix 5 and I read the first 30 pages and I couldn't get any further. So there may be a Planet X, there may be a Nibiru, but it's not going to destroy Earth in 2012.
Okay. Huh. What about meteors, you know, aimed at this planet that are heading in?
We'll be protected. You don't have to worry
and
about
how,
any of that.
And what by what?
The guys who take care of us.
Which is, are you talking aliens? You're talking
aliens.
HARP?
Yeah.
Are you talking? Do we have any idea which aliens are protecting us, or do you?
Probably the Greys. The Greys are responsible for what we call the physical body, which Bob read up at the test site are the containers. They refer to it as containers. That's their job. They see that everything goes okay, and the container contains the souls. The Greys can change souls from body to body, but their responsibility is not the soul. That's somebody else, and I don't know who that person is. The Greys are just here responsible for the containers. That's why there would never, unless extremely unusual circumstances, would a meteor ever hit the Earth. There'd be no catastrophe like that. Let's keep that thought, and I'm going to have something to eat here. Thank you, darling. That was really great.